Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, a conversation about Billy Graham's life as spiritual advisor to America's presidents. But first, to Iraq, where worries about the military situation are being replaced by growing concerns about political instability, 1 month ahead of a much-anticipated Bush administration progress report on the war. U.S. officials in Washington and Baghdad are scrambling to bolster the shaky government of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. Key coalitions of Maliki's government are defecting. And yesterday, Michigan Democrat Carl Levin, the influential chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, just back from Iraq, called on Iraqi lawmakers to vote Maliki out of office. Joining us from Washington now is Farah Stockman, who covers foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. And Farah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Give us a snapshot, if you would, of Nouri al-Maliki's government. Just how shaky is it?
Well, for the past several months, you have seen a lot of defections. First in April, the ministers loyal to Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric, left over Maliki's closeness to the United States and his refusal to call for a timetable of withdrawal. And after they left, just in recent months, just this month, we've seen the main Sunni bloc leave. We've seen the main secular party leave. And this just leaves him with a very narrow group of supporters.
Hmm. Now, you've talked to a number of State Department officials and Iraq analysts. What do they say about the government? Is it close to collapse?
I think that people are very worried. They're concerned. They're frustrated. But so far, people don't think that changing the prime minister is going to solve anything. You have to remember that Maliki replaced Jafari, who 15 months ago was prime minister and was accused of the same sort of reluctance to reach out to Sunnis, the same sort of deadlock, the same sort of stalemate. And so at that time, the U.S. supported Iraqi politicians when they decided to change the prime minister. And now I think they're not, they're not so eager to go down that road.
Hmm. Well, why are people like Carl Levin, we mentioned, the influential chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, he says Maliki should go, that he should be voted out. Is there a better option waiting in the wings? What are people like Carl Levin arguing for?
I think that people are trying to get together a better option in the wings. There are a couple efforts right now in Baghdad to put together coalitions that could ask for a no-confidence vote and try to unseat Maliki. They're trying, but I don't think at this point that U.S. officials see a real viable alternative. And I also think that they realize it's a very critical point for them, because they don't want to go to Congress on September 15th or, that week in September and say, hey, this political upheaval is happening. They're supposed to be showing progress. They're not supposed to be showing a no-confidence vote on the prime minister.
So what's the administration saying and doing to shore up the Maliki government?
I think they've had a lot of meetings, behind-the-scenes meetings, offering advice, passing on information, trying to see what support they can gather. I think President Bush has been very supportive of Maliki and has not been willing to entertain kind of maneuvers that would be seen to undermine him. But I think time is running out, and Maliki has to show some willingness to make compromises and some ability to make progress in order to keep his post.
We've heard reports just recently of several Democrats who have traveled to Iraq this summer and are now expressing some support for the continued troop presence in Iraq, some even shifting positions after they've sort of seen some of the progress over there. And I'm wondering if you can sort of speculate here, how does concern, growing concern about the Maliki government, influence the debate about the presence or the withdrawal of U.S. troops? How do they relate?
Well, I think concern and doubts about Maliki are just another form of ammunition for those who want to argue that Iraq is a lost cause and that we should leave. But, having said that, you mentioned people going over to Iraq and seeing progress. I think that nobody at the same time wants to be blamed for giving up on Iraq, and that nobody wants the gains, the military gains that they've made, to be wasted. And that's part of why I think there's frustration with Maliki, is because the U.S. military feels, hey, we've made progress, we've brought a measure of security to some places, this is your opportunity to move, and you better move. You better use that breathing space, as the administration would call it, in order to create political progress, or else we're going to run out of time.
Well, Farah, thanks for following the story and for joining us today.
Thank you.
Farah Stockman covers foreign affairs for the Boston Globe. The man known as America's Preacher is in a North Carolina hospital today. Reverend Billy Graham is listed in fair condition after being admitted for treatment over the weekend. The nation's most famous evangelist has been ailing for several years with Parkinson's disease and prostate cancer. Graham's wife, Ruth, died in June. A new book chronicles the life and influence of Billy Graham, called The Preacher and the President. It's written by Time Magazine editors Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy. And Michael joins us now. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Tell us about Billy Graham. He had relationships with the past 11 administrations, going back to President Harry Truman, right up to George W. Bush. How did this come to be?
Well, I think he worked hard at it, and the presidents almost worked just as hard as he did. This was a courtship of and by Mr. Graham and the presidents of each other, but Mr. Graham really started things off by working behind the scenes in 1950 to try to get an audience with Harry Truman. He knew exactly who to call, and he got one.
This is a preacher who, and you write this, he was a preacher with no church, who spent his life preaching to football stadiums full of people he never saw again. But the first families gave Graham the rare chance to be a family pastor. He gave them a sanctuary. I'm curious, what are his personal qualities that made that possible? How did he offer them a sanctuary?
I think there were three things. First of all, he learned by experience to be discreet. When he'd first gone in to see Truman, he made the mistake of coming out of the West Wing and telling reporters everything he had said and heard and done, including getting down on his knees and reenacting the prayers. And when that was on the newspaper's front pages the next day, he learned, well, I guess I better not do that again. So he learned discretion the hard way, and that was very valuable. They needed a safe place where they could, talk about their worries and their fears and their doubts and know that it wouldn't end up in the papers. And Eisenhower was the first to experience that. The second thing is that by the mid-1950s, Graham is world famous. He's preached everywhere in the world. He's preached to millions in Times Square. He has a celebrity that is almost rock star quality for an evangelical. And that was something he shared with the president. Hillary Clinton told us, who herself had become close to Mr. Graham over the last 20 years, that he understood what a drag it was to be famous, both what it was good and what was bad about it. And that was something that most presidents don't experience with people they meet every day. The third thing is that because he never built the Church of Billy, and as I say, was an itinerant preacher, the first families became his very small congregation. And it's true of presidents of both parties. So it was a special privilege he enjoyed.
There's some fascinating insights into that you write about that Graham spoke to you about these presidents, and three in particular. And I want you to just talk about it briefly. Dwight Eisenhower, obsessed with the question of heaven. JFK, John F. Kennedy, obsessed with the idea of the world coming to an end, perhaps appropriate for a president in the nuclear age. And Lyndon Johnson, obsessed with his own mortality. These are fascinating moments. What did Graham offer them?
Well, again, I think that we think of presidents as being almost without doubt and without hesitation. They act that way so much in public. They seem to know exactly what they want to do. And talking to Mr. Graham and some of the ex-presidents, too, we learned that they, not surprisingly, have fears and doubts and questions and uncertainties just like the rest of us. Johnson, as you pointed out, was quite worried about his own mortality. He had studies of his family background done. He knew that most of the men in his family had not lived past the age of about 65. He'd had his own troubles before he became president and wanted to have Graham around a lot. He took him on trips because he was worried that planes would crash. He had him up to the White House in his room to pray at his bedside because he was so racked about really tortured about the Vietnam War. And so that was a question of personal mortality. Kennedy, who did not have a close relationship with Graham very much at all, did have him down to play golf right before he was inaugurated. He and Graham spent some time talking about the differences between Catholic doctrine and Protestant doctrine, and had questions about the Second Coming. And I think in terms of Eisenhower, this is someone who had never had much interest in church. His mother had been a Jehovah's Witness, which was not an easy thing to have when you're running for president, at least in the 1950s, had never really liked preachers or going to church. And he asked Graham, what should I be? And Graham said, well, you should be a Presbyterian. And Eisenhower said, well, where should I go to church? And Graham picked one for him in Washington and arranged for the catechisms and all the teachings that Eisenhower would eventually have, because Eisenhower, first among the presidents, and this is one of the reasons they hit it off, really began to mix into his speeches lots more talk about God and faith than the previous presidents had done.
Graham appears to be aware of his unique role, and we're going to listen to just a little cut of tape from Billy Graham. Here he is in an interview that you recorded with him. We got this from the Time Magazine website in his North Carolina home last year. Let's listen to this.
When I started, there was hardly any mention of religion, but as the evangelical side of religion in the press. I think that it was changing very rapidly. With it came the realization in the president's mind that there's something there that they never weren't aware of. That's the political side. Mm-hmm. But on the personal side, I think they began to realize that I didn't quote them. They began to realize that they could talk to me about their own personal feelings and problems and pray with me. And I think I've prayed with all of them.
Michael Duffy, Billy Graham seems to be alluding to this sort of idea of this fine line between the personal and the political. How did he walk that fine line?
That's a great question. His White House ministry was designed from the start to, I think, bring the gospel into the Oval Office so that the presidents would talk about this more in their own speeches. But also, he wanted, because he was an evangelist, wanted to make sure that the presidents came to Jesus. I mean, this was part of what he does and still does. And for the most part, Graham talks, and so did Eisenhower, about the need to, again, you know, sort of fold more of that conversation into their speeches, particularly as the Cold War began. They felt this was an advantage that the U.S. and the West had over the Soviet Union, a place which had outlawed religion, and they made it part of their campaign, whether it was putting Under God in this Pledge of Allegiance in that decade, or adding, you know, that to the coinage. I mean, there was a lot of this that just simply took place in that era, and Graham was part of that campaign. I think what developed, to his surprise, was this personal pastoring to the presidents. Once he got in and once they realized he was influential and a good judge of, he was pretty interested in politics and pretty good at reading the country's mood, they came to rely on him in more personal ways. I don't think that's why he went there in the first place, but that's one of the things why he was able to stay for such a long duration.
That's Michael Duffy of Time Magazine talking about Reverend Billy Graham and his role as spiritual advisor to the nation's presidents. We'll be back with more about the preacher and the presidents after a quick break. Stick around here and now. Here and now, we're talking about Billy Graham, longtime evangelist and spiritual advisor to the Oval Office. For more than 50 years, Graham has held sway with 11 presidents, providing pastoral care, and as Michael Duffy told us, pulling political weight as well. Michael is co-author of a new book about Graham. It's called The Preacher and the Presidents. And Michael, we're talking about how Graham has been a personal pastor to the First Families. You write of one time when a pre-presidential George W. Bush got into an argument with his mother, Barbara Bush, about who gets into heaven. Tell us that story and explain how Billy Graham became involved in the argument.
In about 1987 or 88, when Bush Sr. is still vice president, George W. Bush, his then 40-something son, is talking at the vice presidential residence with his mother, Barbara Bush, about who and who can't get into heaven. By this time, George W. Bush had begun to read the Bible. He'd met Billy Graham. He'd started on a whole new journey toward his own faith and rebirth. And he was telling his mother that only born-again Christians can get into heaven. And Barbara Bush said, oh, sorry, that's not right. And W. said, yeah, it is. and Barbara, who had by this time had known Billy Graham for a dozen years. So, well, let's get Billy Graham on the phone and let him settle this, which is a very nice thing to have in your back pocket when you
right.
run
every
into
family
these,
should
these
have
dinner
that.
Time conversations. Right. And sure enough, the White House operators, because they serve the vice president's mansion, got Graham on the phone. Graham comes to the phone and he says to them, "Well, look, technically W is right. You know, only born-again Christians can get into heaven. But I would urge all of you to be very careful about playing God, because only he can know the human heart." And that's how the matter was settled. Now, George W. Bush, who was not yet governor of Texas, did not tell this story until he ran for governor. But when he did tell that story in Texas in 1994, it was designed to do two things. First, signal that he was, in fact, a practicing Christian. And two, signal that he wasn't intolerant about it, because he'd learned from the master. It was a nice calling card.
You also write that Graham has said that politics has been ugly to me. And we've talked about sort of how he walked that fine line between the political and the personal. But what do we know about his politics? I mean, he did use his position to lobby lawmakers on certain issues, such as a poverty bill or an arms deal. And you cite in your Time article this month issues that he championed and how much political weight Graham actually carried in his career.
Yeah, I think the main role that politics played was that I think he sees it as he was fascinated by politics, he was fascinated by politicians. I don't think Graham was ever tempted by money, as other preachers have been, or by women, as other preachers have been, but I think he was really tempted by politics and power. He felt a tug. He referred to it once as a weakness, because he couldn't get over it. And while it did great things for his ministry, and it opened doors for his ministry in Eastern Europe and overseas in places he couldn't otherwise go, he did like being part of this whole conversation and knowing them personally and helping them. This was also a huge, huge win for evangelism. I mean, don't forget, after the Scopes trial in 1925, fundamentalists and to a lesser extent evangelists really were on the outs of the U.S. power structure. They were seen as, you know, anti-intellectual and not thinking and didn't want to hear about science and didn't want to hear about, you know, modern life. And that really was the rule for 25 or 30 years after Scopes. But then along comes Billy Graham, you know, out of Charlotte, North Carolina, and he begins to attract huge audiences like no mainline or Protestant preacher. Those churches aren't sure what to make of him, but as flock and audience grows, they have to take him seriously. But nothing made him taken so seriously as having these relationships with the presidents of the United States. It was a huge, huge gift to evangelism that Graham created, and no one else could have done it. There were numerous tasks and missions he played for the presidents. Most of those lobbying things where he would lobby for an AWACS sale or for Peace Corps money in the Johnson years were done at the behest of the president. Mm. They asked him for help.
Well, he seemed very proud of that. I want to play one more clip of audio from your interview last year. And here we hear Billy Graham talking about his belief that presidents are just people. Let's listen to that.
After you get to know them for a little while, they just sit down in the living room or bedroom or wherever in their everyday clothes, and you talk about everything. You talk about the family, you talk about some problem that may be facing them as a family. I had that experience a lot.
Michael Duffy, Billy Graham sounds quite weak in these audio clips. How is he doing these days?
Well, you know, he's 88, so he has all of the things that come with getting older. He's quite at peace about that. He, you know, he lost his wife in June, his wife of nearly 64 years, and that's been hard for him. In the magazine, he talks about that for the first time and how he just is overwhelmed sometimes by how much he misses her and how, you know, he's preached all his life that there is a reward after life, and he's struggled with it a little bit. Physically, he has macular degeneration in his eyes, and he has treatments for that. And, of course, on Saturday morning, he was admitted to the Nashville hospital for what seems to be intestinal bleeding. He's had two bouts of it in the last 3 days. He's still listed in fair and stable condition. Talking to him is an experience that's quite extraordinary. He's very welcoming, and he's very thoughtful. You have to give him some time to think through the questions, but then he usually has very interesting and helpful things to say. We found the interviews just to be we could have done them all, just gone on and on and on. There's nothing quite like meeting him. It's a great experience. And he said to us, you know, he didn't shy away from the mistakes he'd made. He said, there were lots of mistakes I made, and he was quick to talk about them.
Is there another Billy Graham waiting in the wings? Can there ever be another, that kind of relationship between a pastor and presidents, do you think?
I think it's a little bit like another Einstein or another Michael Jordan. I think he was one of the great figures of the 20th century. I think he came along at the right moment of the Cold War and television and a great awakening going on in the United States, and who had the drive. This was a AAA personality we were dealing with. And it's hard to see it at 88, but there are glimpses where you can see this. He was very driven to preach, and I can't imagine there'll be anyone quite like him ever again. He preached to 200 million people in the world. There's nobody can come close to that, and it'll be a long time before I think anyone does.
Michael Duffy, thanks so much again for talking to us.
You're very welcome.
That's Michael Duffy. He's co-author of the new book on Billy Graham, The Preacher and the Presidents. He's also assistant managing editor of Time magazine. You can link to Michael's audio interview with Graham through our website at here-now.org. Tomorrow on Here and Now, 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, is the federal government listening to what state emergency workers have to say about disaster response? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, a private equity firm now owns Chrysler. Can the automaker be saved? Wall Street and Washington are nervous about the deal. That's still to come on Here and Now. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. And now, the deal to save Chrysler. Is it doomed? It's no secret that Chrysler is in trouble. Once the nation's biggest automaker, Chrysler, if not quite a total wreck, has fallen to fourth place in the North American market. So can the private equity firm, Cerberus Capital Management, and its secretive CEO, Steve Feinberg, save the ailing carmaker? That's the question Wall Street and Washington are asking about the deal, in which Daimler-Benz sold Chrysler to Cerberus for $7.4 billion, about a fifth of what the German company paid for it back in 1998. Journalist Daniel Roth writes about the deal in the September issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine, and he joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
The headline on your story calls this the most dangerous deal in America, one that terrifies Wall Street. Why is that?
There are a couple reasons. Number one is, from Wall Street's point of view, this might be the last great buyout. The buyout bubble is pretty much popped, and it looks like Cerberus was able to sneak in under the wire, get the banks to commit something like $63 billion in debt for this deal. And it doesn't look like that kind of money is going to be available for anyone else. So they're worried about whether banks are choking on the debt because of this Chrysler deal. That's one part of the problem. The other reason this is so dangerous is because Steve Feinberg has bought a American icon. And the fear is that if he decides to do what private equity guys do sometimes, which is to strip a company of its assets and sell them off and cut the workforce by significant numbers, that Washington, which has already been beating up on private equity quite a bit, will come down pretty hard on the industry and start saying they've got to reveal more about themselves, they've got to operate with greater transparency. So this is a deal fraught with problems for the investing world.
Well, you mentioned Steven Feinberg, and he is the head of Cerberus Capital Management. Tell us about him. He's sort of an interesting character. He's someone who doesn't like to be photographed, never allows his employees to talk on the record. It's kind of a interesting company, to say the least.
In an industry that's very private, he is the most private. He is incredibly reclusive. He is a figure who doesn't like to ever talk. He hired a PR guy to tell other journalists that they are not allowed to talk to him. He does whatever he can to hide. And he, at this investor meeting in the spring, he told all of his investors, as a matter of talking about some of the attention that the private equity people are getting, he said, if any of my people ever show up in the paper, we'll do more than fire that person. We will kill him. The jail sentence will be worth it.
Oh, my.
So he's someone that takes his secrecy and the secrecy of his employees pretty seriously.
And what's his company's track record?
Cerberus has done very well for its investors. They get, like other private equity firms, it relies on pension funds and very wealthy families to invest with them. They manage to do deals with less risk than a lot of other private equity firms. And if you look at their four funds, they have all consistently beaten their peers. And so far, the guy really hasn't lost at all. And this will be the deal that really determines, though, just how successful he is.
Well, what does he see in Chrysler? What's Cerberus's plan to fix Chrysler? I mean, as you mentioned, he's taking on a huge risk, $60 billion in debt. This at a time when the credit markets are imploding. It just seems like an extremely risky proposition.
Oh, yeah, it's incredibly risky. One of Chrysler's biggest problems is it's $18 billion in liabilities owed to its retiree health care plan. And the unions wouldn't cut Daimler-Chrysler a deal because Daimler-Chrysler actually made money, and they said, we can't ask our workers to make sacrifices for a company that is making so much money. So Cerberus takes this company out of Daimler-Chrysler's hands. It's now a money-losing operation. They can go back to the unions, and they should be able to get some kind of a deal regarding the retiree health care plan. That should help them out. Number two, Daimler-Chrysler spent a lot of money developing new models for Chrysler. They've sold this to Cerberus at a time where Cerberus doesn't have to spend any money developing these cars. They now get them. They get all the R&D work for free, basically. This makes the deal a lot more lucrative for him. And three, he might be able to sell this off. There are a lot of companies that wouldn't mind being able to get a hold of Chrysler's dealers. There are Chinese companies that want into the U.S. They could do some kind of a big partnership with Chrysler. As a private equity firm, he has a lot more ability to do things that would be politically untenable in the world of public companies. And he operates under the radar and can make changes that other people can't. And if you look at just who he brought in as CEO, Robert Nardelli, who was a former CEO of Home Depot, is now running Chrysler. This is a guy that was pretty widely vilified in the corporate world for the way he ran Home Depot and the amount of money he managed to take out of the firm for himself. And Steve Feinberg doesn't have to worry about this guy's image. It's a private company. He can just stick Nardelli in and say, you know, use your GE magic here and see what you can do.
You know, I was struck by a quote which sort of gets back to this issue of just how sick Chrysler is. You have a quote from Gerald Myers, the former CEO of American Motors and a professor at the University of Michigan Ross School of Business. And he says, there's no economic justification for Chrysler Corporation to exist at all. Whatever they can do, someone else can do better. And yet there's still some value in it for someone like Feinberg and his company's Cerberus.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, just because someone else can do it better doesn't mean they wouldn't necessarily want to have the Chrysler brands. Those brands are worth a lot of money. And, you know, Feinberg is betting he can turn around the company. But if he can't, he has a lot of exits he can choose from.
So what's the bottom line? Does it really matter if Cerberus saves Chrysler? I mean, they're going to figure out a way to make money either way, it seems.
Does it matter to Cerberus? No. Does it matter to workers? Does it matter to the state of Michigan, to Washington? Oh, my God, yeah. There are about 80,000 people working at Chrysler. Most of those jobs are located in Michigan and Ohio, two incredibly important swing states, obviously. And these politicians are not going to be happy if they have tens of thousands of layoffs in their home state because a private equity firm decides it can make money by laying off these people. So this deal is being very, very closely watched by Washington, and Feinberg, who hates being in the spotlight, is now very much in the spotlight.
Hmm. What are you hearing in reporting the story from auto workers? I was actually living in Michigan when this deal was announced, and the initial response from the unions, for example, was, I mean, I'm not sure if they were sort of trying to put, the best face on this, but they were pretty positive about the deal, that this might actually, lead to some kind of job security down the road.
The union heads have all been very vocally positive about Cerberus taking over the company. Mm-hmm. The rank and file, however, have been exactly the opposite. And they're terrified. And I talked to one woman who said to me, talking about, you know, Cerberus is the company's named after the three-headed dog that guards hell.
And I wanted to ask you about that.
And you know, that is not a, as this employee said to me, you know, they didn't name the company after a fluffy white puppy. It's not exactly welcoming to employees. So they're worried about it. They know this company has a history of going in and doing what's best for their investors, but not necessarily what's in the best interest of employees. You know, they have a fiduciary duty to make money out of these deals, and sometimes employees get hurt in the process. And I think the union chiefs see Feinberg as someone they can work with. They liked the idea of being able to work with the current CEO of Chrysler. Although Feinberg, after closing the deal, did put in Nardelli, so he certainly has been sending a mixed message to the unions. The negotiations are going on right now, and they'll end in mid-September, so we'll see whether the unions made the right call in saying this is someone they can work with or not.
Well, Daniel, it's a fascinating story. Thanks for keeping track of it, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Daniel Roth. His story about the Chrysler takeover appears in the September issue of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. Before we go today, the science behind a smile, and from China, foot trolleys of death. We'll explain. You're listening to Here and Now. In recent months, we've heard numerous reports about potentially dangerous products made in China, from lead-painted toys to contaminated food. Just today, we found out that New Zealand officials are investigating Chinese-made pajamas that contain dangerous levels of the chemical formaldehyde. But wait, the hits just keep on coming. Now, government officials in Britain are alarmed about another Chinese import. And truth be told, this one sounds like a lot of fun if it weren't for the fact that it could pretty easily kill or cripple the user. We're talking about Chinese-made gas-powered rollerblades. They can go up to 20 miles per hour, and they don't have any brakes. Who needs brakes when you're having so much fun? But one British website called them foot trolleys of death after the government seized 50 pairs of them. And we're joined now by David Morton. Mr. Morton is the senior trading standards officer for the Bournemouth Borough Council, which is on the south coast of England. And Mr. Morton, welcome.
Thank you.
Can you describe these skates for us?
The left skate is an ordinary roller blade. And the right one has a 25cc engine attached to the rear of it, and that propels you along.
And you just zoom along. And we should say, for people who don't know, a 25cc engine, that's about half the size of a moped, propelling essentially just a human body.
Yes, that's right. So you haven't got the weight of the moped.
Now, we went to a website, a Chinese website, advertising the skates that has a video of people casually skating around a fountain in a town center with descriptions of the skate in Chinese. Let's listen for a moment.
原因一,汽油机配分性差,处理方法,更换体...
Now, there are some poorly translated English subtitles with suggestions like this, and I'm quoting precisely as they're written. If the ignition system no work, way to solve, check the high voltage bag. Oldster, child, gingerly to use. Mr. Morton, how dangerous are these gas-powered skates in your view?
Yes, certainly. We think they're very dangerous. We're concerned about the petrol tank, that in the event of an accident it could rupture, and we're worried about the controls because the police tried here and they didn't wear them at all or anything like that. The actual kill button didn't work, so they couldn't get the motor to stop.
Now, the 32-year-old man who was planning to sell these skates on the internet is now warning people not to import products from China without working with your office. But there are ads for something else called G-Wheels, high-powered super skateboard almost. They go for about $990, and I understand you just seized these as well?
Yeah, we've seized one of these items. Yeah, in fact, I've just been looking at it with the local police.
And what are G-Wheels?
The engine on this is a 50cc engine. It looks like a little motorbike, but it's considerably different in that you don't sit on it, but you, if you're, say, right-footed, you would put your left foot on a board which goes through the back wheel, and then you would put your right foot on a board which goes through the front wheel.
You know, my producer, in preparing this segment, did a little research and was Googling, and we found one product apparently being sold by a 10-year-old child, according to the website. He was advertising something called a Sky Runner, which is basically metal coils, almost like slinkies strapped to the bottom of your shoes, and it allowed this young man to do flips over trucks, forward flips, back flips. I mean, he was very skilled, but again, it looked quite perilous for the inexperienced user. How do things like this get on the marketplace?
In theory, nothing that's unsafe should come into, certainly into the UK, but there is no procedure of actually vetting things before they're imported, because that would be impossible, really. So the onus is on people who choose to import them to make sure that they're safe. And if they're not safe, they suffer the consequences of having them seized and possibly being prosecuted and fined.
Perils of the global marketplace. Well, David Morton, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thanks very much, Anthony.
That's David Morton, Senior Trading Standards Officer for the Bournemouth Borough Council, talking to us about the Chinese-made gasoline-powered skates that have turned up in the UK, among other dangerous products. Up next, the science of smiling, coming up here and now. It's here and now.
Oh, when you're smiling, smiling.
As it turns out, a simple smile, one of the most natural expressions of human emotion, can be extremely complicated. A smile can communicate happiness, amusement, and joy, of course, but it can also mean embarrassment, sarcasm, even a kind of grin and bear it distress. And for researchers, understanding what's behind the human smile is a complex and serious business. An article in this month's Smithsonian Magazine considers the smile, the science behind it, and how it affects human behavior. It was written by Richard Conniff, who joins us now from Yale University in New Haven. And Richard, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
A lot of interesting ideas in this piece that you wrote about the smile, including how some of the first serious research on the smile began with a French physician and victims of the guillotine.
There was a Paris physician named Guillaume Duchesne. He was working on a patient who had facial neuralgia, and he noticed that when he applied electrical currents, it caused the underlying muscles to contract sharply, and that got him interested. So he wanted to do further studies, but it was too painful to do that on living human beings. So he got criminals and revolutionaries who had been executed on the guillotine and applied the same technique, electrical stimulation, to their faces, and found that he could produce recognizable human emotions, including the smile, although, of course, it wasn't a happy one.
Hmm. Now, he was among the first to argue that smiling and other facial expressions represent a sort of universal language, is that right, rather than the result of social conditioning?
Yeah, that's right. The idea is that our facial expressions are biological and mechanistic, and that we do these things unconsciously, and we understand them and respond to them unconsciously, and that they were built into our evolution over millions of years.
Hmm. And so what does that mean about social differences? I mean, we've all been to countries and cultures where it seems like people smile much less than Americans, who seem to be crazy about smiling.
That's quite true. I mean, in Japan, there's a cultural rule against too much emotional expression. It's considered an imposition. And yet those people also smile in exactly the same ways we do. For instance, there was a study done of a recent Olympics. They were studying the response of people after they had won a judo match. And in that instant after victory, the Japanese victors would smile just the way an American victor would. And then they would suppress the smile because it was considered rude to be smiling in the face of the person you had just defeated.
And you write that, for example, the Chinese, in preparation for the next Olympics, are giving a lot of people crash training in how to smile more readily.
Yeah, they want to turn Beijing into a city of smiles, and they are training 100,000 volunteers to smile at anybody who gets within a 10-foot radius, which I think is frankly frightening. Hmm. But they think it'll make people more comfortable and that the smile is a kind of a universal language that says welcome.
Well, what does the research show on that? I mean, does it necessarily make people more comfortable if I walk into a store and someone is smiling at me, or if I turn on my computer and reach for the help button, I get a smile? Does it automatically mean, you know, my life, my day is going to be better?
No. People are very aware of facial expressions and what they mean and all of the subtle nuances that are involved. There's actually a case that's pretty notorious of Microsoft had an avatar, an icon, I guess you would call it, that they put on their computers. It was called Clippy.
Clippy, the little guy that would show up and say, "I see you're about to write a letter. Can I help you?" And I found that extremely annoying, actually.
Exactly. And almost everyone found it annoying. It would give you this gratuitous advice. And then when you had a real problem, it was always smiling at you. And that was just annoying, even angering. People really hated Clippy. And eventually, Microsoft took the hint and got rid of it.
Hmm.
The trick is that the facial expression really has to be appropriate to the context. And that's not something that's easy for any computer or other device to get down right. I mean, it's something humans have taken millions of years to develop.
You were talking about millions of years to develop. The smile, commonly associated with pleasure, but you write that it may have had its origins in fear.
Yeah. People think that the smile and the laugh are connected, that the smile is sort of a milder version of the laugh. But when primatologists have gone and looked at these two things carefully, they find that the laugh is connected to a play face that you see in primates, and you see it in your dog. You know, that expression where the mouth is open and they're sort of panting a little bit with anticipation. But the smile dates back to a kind of fear grimace, which monkeys and apes display when they're being submissive, saying basically, don't eat me. And we still use the smile in that same way as a kind of appeasement or as a way of disarming people and preventing them from doing something rude or aggressive.
You also write, and this I was really intrigued with, that smiles can be indicators of marital harmony and future success.
Well, there was one study. It's still going on. It's been going on for 40 years out of Mills College in Oakland, California. And they look at these women and how their lives unfold. And one of the things they looked at was their yearbook photos, which you wouldn't think would be particularly revealing because that was only one moment in time many years ago. But they found that, in fact, the women who were smiling more and who were smiling what's called a Duchenne smile, which is a smile of genuine happiness with crinkling around the eyes, those women tended to end up having more success in their careers, more romantic happiness in later life, and that this Duchenne smile indicated less stress and anxiety and increasing confidence about getting along with people and achieving their goals.
Smile, though your heart is aching.
We've all encountered this example numerous times in our life where you're down and someone will say to you, smile. You know, you'll feel better if you smile. Is that true? I mean, is there some research that suggests that, in fact, if we're encouraged to smile, it might actually have a positive effect on our mood?
Yeah, there is a lot of research that suggests that. For instance, there's this thing called the Strack test. In that test, subjects watch a cartoon while sitting for a minute with a pen held crosswise between the molars, which pulls the lips back into a smile. Another group watches the same cartoon or the same show with the pencil held between the lips outside the teeth so that they can't smile. And the ones who have the sort of forced smile wind up thinking that the cartoon is funnier. There's a suggestion from that sort of thing that smiling actually does make you happier.
Is there an on the other hand? I mean, you close the piece with an anecdote about this happy shopkeeper who greets all of her customers with a smile and says, how are you? And clearly expects that kind of response in the back. But one of the people you quote always responds to the shopkeeper, I hate everything. And it turns out that the shopkeeper sort of confesses that she's relieved because as she tells her, yeah, I hate everything too. I've got reasons to be sad.
That woman's husband was dying. And when the first woman came in one day, the clerk said, so how are you? And the other woman said, oh, I'm fine. And she just forgot to say what she normally said. She forgot to say, I hate everything. And the clerk said, no, how are you really? And finally, the woman said, I hate everything. And the clerk said, yeah, I hate everything too. And thereafter, the two of them greeted each other every time by saying, I hate everything. And then they broke into a big smile. So in a way, it was sort of an act of rebellion against the forced smile and the idea that, you know, smiling is always going to make you happy. It was a way of saying, well, you know, sometimes things aren't that great, but they connected on that level and smiled together. It was kind of a nice ending.
Richard Conniff, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Anthony. My pleasure.
That's Richard Conniff. His article, What's Behind a Smile, is in this month's issue of Smithsonian Magazine.
Vision is overwhelming. The possibilities still remain. But I don't smile if I don't want to, want to. I don't smile if I don't want to, want to.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Join us again tomorrow and keep smiling, even if you don't want to. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.